Okay, thank you so much for that beautiful and brief introduction. It's nice to see some familiar faces, some not familiar faces, and I hope to be able to grow together. You know, today, days like today and programs like this are opportunities for all of us to be able to review, to be able to learn, to be inspired, and to grow in all different ways. And perhaps even more than that, it's an opportunity for all of us to be able to reflect on who we are as parents. If we're not parents yet, then who we are as educators. If we're not educators yet, then just who we are as Jews. And it's a wonderful opportunity. Many years ago, when I was training, I had the privilege of actually training in graduate school in parent management techniques. And I was taking classes, and I was also, at the same time, I was working with families in the Bronx, in the inner city community of the Bronx. Many single-parent families, very complicated situations. And I was training, and I said, oh, this is like, you know, we lament sometimes that a handbook, a instruction manual did not come out of the womb with our child. So I had the closest thing to that. I had many manuals that didn't come with my child, but they, you know, that I was studying. And one day I came home to my apartment. We had two children at the time. And the other situation, I don't know, it was bath time, and you know, it's always difficult at nights, and I was dealing with a situation, and to put it mildly, I didn't handle it in the textbook manual kind of way that I probably should have. And my wife looked at me very gently and softly and said to me, "What you just did, is that what you would have told one of your clients to do?" And it was a gentle way of saying, maybe we got to rethink about, you know, and so on. And in so many ways, parenting is exciting, and it's special, and it's beautiful, and it's challenging, and it's extremely humbling. And so when I say that we're going to learn, and we're going to grow, and be inspired, and reflect together, I really mean together. Because for all of us, no matter how much training we have, and no matter how much experience we have, the specialness of parenting is certainly, I would say, outmatched by the humbling nature of parenting. And I hope today to be able to grow with you, and to be able to learn with you, and to be inspired, and to reflect with you together. There, when we look at relationships, what we have to look at are three different components. There's the I, the ani. There's the thou, the who, the other. And then there's the dynamic that exists in between the two. And so as we embark on our journey to understand a little bit of this idea of connected parenting, and we'll go through some Torah sources, some psychology sources, some sources that for better or for worse I made up, and we'll learn and hopefully grow together understanding these various components. And when we're done, B'li Neder, B'ezrat Hashem, I hope to leave you with some real techniques that we can not only leave in the air of inspiration, but really on the ground in terms of implementation. The first place that I always like to look when it comes to parenting is the story of Shimshon. It's a story that we think of in certain ways, but usually not about parenting. So Shimshon's father, Manoach, and his wife were childless for many years. And the Torah tells us that they davened for children, and eventually a Malach Hashem, an Ish, comes to visit Manoach's wife and gives explicit directions that their child, who's going to be known as Shimshon, is going to be a Nazir Mibeten. He's going to be a Nazirite from the womb, the first one I think we have in all of Tanakh, who's going to have all these restrictions before he's even born. And it's confusing because it's the first time. We don't know what does it mean. So when this man had visited Manoach's wife and his wife reported to Manoach, Manoach was confused. So he davened to Hashem and said, "Please let this man come back and share with me some of the details because I'm a little bit confused." So he davened to Hashem, can this Malach, this messenger come back? And the messenger comes back. And he says to Manoach, says to the messenger, "What's the story?" He says, if you look at the in source number one, Pasuk Yud Bet, Vayomer Manoach, Ataya Vod Varecha, Mayiyem Mishpat Hanaru Ma'asehu. What are the rules here? This is a new game. We've never played it before. Give me some detail. Now listen so carefully what the Malach says back to Manoach. Vayomer Malach Hashem Manoach, Mikol asher amarti el ha'isha tishamer. Everything that I have just delineated to your wife, tishamer. Now, tishamer has a linguistic ambiguity to it. Because when you have that tuf, tishamer, in Hebrew, it can mean one of two things. Tishamer, grammatically, can mean third person feminine, in which case he's referring to Manoach's wife. But tishamer can also mean second person masculine, meaning we're talking to you, Manoach. So what is the Malach saying to Manoach? The Malach is saying to Manoach, whatever dictates, whatever rules I've just delineated for your son, you have to keep. You have to model. And so before we even begin to think of how we're going to parent and what we're going to do and all the interventions we're going to put into place, the first thing we have to say to ourselves is, what are we doing? What are we modeling for our child? Now you might think, okay, this is obvious, it's intuitive, but in the history of psychology, the idea of modeling was not always so intuitive. For many years, in the middle of the 20th century, the prominent thinking was that in order to teach skills to children or to teach any skills to ourselves, we had to use different types of conditioning. Famously, the Pavlovian conditioning or classical conditioning, where we pair a certain event, we ring the bell, we bring the food, so that whenever we ring the bell, we'll elicit the same response in the dog. Classical condition. Then that evolved or developed into operant conditioning, where we gave rewards and punishments. And that was considered to be the method of teaching. Conditioning, behavior modification, using classical or operant conditioning. Comes along a fellow by the name of Albert Bandura, and he says that's not really how people learn. It's not only the way that people learn. In fact, there's a more prominent feature that takes place of how people learn. And he developed, in the context that we call social learning theory, the importance of modeling. And it was a chiddush, it was a novelty at that time. So if you look inside, just to give you a sense, in source number two, bullet number one, learning, he said, was not purely behavioral, but it was a cognitive process that takes place in a social context. It's being aware of one's environment, learning from that environment. Learning, number two, can occur by observing a behavior and by observing the consequences of behavior. And so he developed this idea of learning through watching others, modeling for others what you would like to teach them. And in many ways, modeling had begun to eclipse the importance, to some degree, of the conditioning classical and operant that had been there before. But let me give you an example. So you have a story, you have a classic story, a little child wants to come, opens the fridge up and says, "Mommy, Daddy, I'd like to pour the milk for my cereal." So it's not the milk. He takes out, of course, you know, the gallon container that's larger than he or she is. And you say, "You know, please, Tati, you know, please don't pour the milk. It's gonna spill all over the floor." But of course, no, he ignores the command, the directive, and he pours the milk. And the milk just keeps pouring. And you're watching the sun. Just like you knew exactly what was gonna happen. The milk's all over the floor. So now you have a choice. What are your choices? You can say one of two things. You can say, "Listen, I told you not to pour the milk. So the result of that, the conditioning approach of that, the punishment, the consequence that you're going to get is that you spilled the milk. So now you have to clean it up. That's it." That's one approach. But you know in the back of your mind, you know what you're trying to teach your child in a different area, is to be helpful, to be compliant, to participate in the family. So you say, "No." Or I can say, "You know, listen, Tati, you made a mistake. You know it's a mistake." And the child feels bad because the milk's all over the floor and he knows you were right. So you say, "You know what? Why don't I help you clean up the milk? I'll model for you what compliance is. And then, I'll we'll see what happens." And you have a choice to give a consequence or to model. So Bandura would tell you that the more powerful message you'll send your child is by modeling for him or her that compliance rather than giving the consequence. Because they're going to watch what you did more than take heed to what you told them. And it's a profound message, but it's more than just how we teach our children in interactions. It's how we carry ourselves. How we live our lives, how we model ourselves, not even directly in our interactions with our children, is going to set the bar for where they want to achieve, whether we realize it or not. One of my favorite quotes you have in source number three is from Ralph Waldo Emerson. Ralph Waldo Emerson's writing in the context of a political essay. And he writes, don't say things. Who you are stands over you the while and thunders that I cannot hear what you say to the contrary. You can say what you will, but who we are will thunder so loudly that if we say something to the opposite, it will not be heard. It will not even matter. That's the importance of modeling, but I want to show you how this takes place in modern society. If you go to page number 5, in the very back, I apologize, the print didn't come out so well, but you'll see it in the, if you go to the website, I'll explain to you what this is. There's an organization called Making Caring Common that works out of the Harvard Graduate School of Education. And this is an infograph that they provided. What do they do? Fascinating. They took 10,000, that's a big study, 10,000 middle school and high school kids from all over the country, from all different socioeconomic backgrounds. And they gave them questions that wanted to tap into their value structure. What do you value? What do your parents value? And they asked them the kind of questions like this. Create a hierarchy. What's more important for you? Achievement, accomplishment, we could probably put in that category, financial success, happiness, or caring for others. 10,000, that's a very large number of middle school and high school kids. And look at what the numbers came out with. If you go to the website, you can see it more in detail. If you look in the top here, this top tier of the infograph, 80% said that happiness was their top priority or achievement. Only 20% said that caring for others was their top priority. That's 8,000. Give you just a number. 8,000 out of 10,000 kids. Now, is that the kind of society that we're creating? In the context of that study, they also came across the next tier of numbers, which is that 30% of middle school is reported being bullied. More than 50% of girls between 7th and 12th grade, children, 11 to 17-year-olds, reported being sexually harassed. And 50% had cheated in high school. Whew. Try to make that, connect the dots, right, between the 80% of achievement and happiness and these numbers. So they wondered, where did this come from? Is this a society that we want to create? So then they asked the kids, they said, what about your parents? What do you think your parents value? And they asked the parents, what do you value? The parents of these same children. So look now, jump a tier. And this is what the parents said. The parents said, we want caring kids. 96% of the parents said that moral character is very important, if not essential. That's what the parents said. But watch what the children understood. Right next to it, the children said, that's not what I heard. 81%, eerily close to the 80% that we had above, said that they think that happiness and achievement is their parents' top priority. The parents might have talked the talk, but the kids don't care about the talk. They care about if their parents walk the walk. It thundered so loudly over their heads that the parents really cared about achievement and happiness that it didn't matter that the parents said 96% that they would prefer ethics. Let me give you a quote of just how powerful this message is. One child in the study said, if you're not happy, life is nothing. And after that, you want to do well. And after that, expend any excess energy on others. Is that the kind of community that we want? So it's a point of reflection. It's something to think about. Mikol asher amarti al ha'isha tishamer. If we want our children to be great children, so the first thing we have to reflect upon is to realize that we have to model for them. We have to not say things, but we have to do things. And this, what the study calls the reality-rhetoric gap. It's the gap between the rhetoric, what the parents say, and the reality, what's actually taking place on the ground, is something that as parents, as we begin our relationship with our children, we have to first be cognizant of. But then, after we look at the I, we have to look at the thou. We have to look at the child. We have to understand, how do we view our children? And here we have a very, very famous sefer. If you haven't read it, I would encourage you to read it. It's written in Hebrew. It's translated beautifully into English. It's about this thin. It's about, I mean, maybe 80 to 100 pages, both in Hebrew and in English. And it's written, it's a book called Zriyahu Binyan B'chinuch, I think it's translated in English to Planting and Building and Education, written by the great Shlomo Valbe. Shlomo Valbe was born in 1914, he died in 2005, very, very much a contemporary. Many of us have had the zechus, we've been in Israel to go to his Beis HaMusar and to learn from him directly, but he has many, many sfarim. This book on education was profound on a number of levels, because even within his own community, he was an iconoclast. He really changed in many ways different approaches to education that had already existed in the more Haredi community. And so what he did was he explained that when we look at children, there are two ways that we can look at our interactions with them. On the one hand, we can look at them through the lens of what we call zriya, of planting. We're not really doing anything. You can't just go to the ground and pull the plant out of the ground. What do? You water it, you expose it to sunlight, you give it nutrients, and you allow it to grow on its own. It's organic. But he says, in a very strong language, at the very end, on page number 3, he says in the bolded, "Notim layel letzmoach v'legdol mibli levnototo." If we allow a child just to grow without building, which we'll talk about in a moment, you'll say para adam, it becomes wild. If we don't control the growth, it goes wherever it goes. But then there's binyan. Binyan is a very structured approach to construction. We have an architectural plan. We follow it to the detail. We have a sketch. We put it in place. And then we build. We put the blocks in place. Everything is rigid. It has to be that way. And says Rav Volbe, if we just build without planting, without organic growth, very powerfully, he says, Osim mimenu robot. You have a robot. So says Rav Volbe, as to his title of his book, we have to both plant and to build. Hatsiruf shel shnei hadvarim yachad. The combination, the integration of these two components, setting parameters, having an architectural plan, but also allowing organic and healthy growth, patience and time, providing nutrients and water and sunlight. That balance, koach hatzmicha u'maaseh habinyan, zehu hachinuch. That is education. And he tells a story as an example. In the book, he tells a story, Tzadik Echad. Now, if Rav Volbe is calling him a Tzadik Echad, so you mean that he's like the real Tzadik. Doesn't say the name, obviously. Who comes to him in his office with a child who will not talk. And he says to him, he says, you know, this is my son, and he doesn't talk. So Rav Volbe said, can you tell me about him? So he says, the tzaddik said, this boy is going to be a tzaddik like nobody's seen before. He's not allowed to play. He's not allowed to have fun. He's just going to learn. He's just going to grow, but not organically, within the rigid confines of building, with no flexibility. And the child was intellectually and emotionally paralyzed by the rigidity of this approach. And Rav Volbe says, unfortunately, the boy did not stay within the formal confines of religious Judaism, unfortunately. And he laments the fact. So we have to strike that balance. When we look at our children, we strike the balance between building and between planting. We have to put proper guidelines in place with structure and planning, but we also at the same time have to be patient to allow our children to grow organically as we provide for them whatever the needs may be. So we have the modeling, we have the ani, the I, we have the who, we have the other. But now, with that foundation, let's move to the most important piece, which is the relationship. And here I'd like to describe the relationship and give you a couple of techniques that I use in the schools that I work in and also in my private practice, my own home, I hope. And hopefully leave you with things that are concrete. In source number 5, a very famous Gemara, the Gemara says, Tanu Rabbanan, Le'olam tehi smol docha v'yamin mekarevet. That when we educate our children, we have to push away with our left hand, but the overwhelming feeling, that strong right hand, has to bring our children close. And so on the one hand, we look at it, okay, we have to do more of this, less of that, and that's the balance that we have. Dr. Pelkovitz, who I just saw this morning, he says very beautifully that if we just push or if we just pull with both of our hands, the child is still facing the same direction. But if we pull with one hand and push with the other, that's how we can get the child to turn and to move into a different direction. It's a beautiful insight in this Gemara. But what does this look like? What is the yamin mikarevet and the smol docha, the right hand bringing close, the left hand pushing away? What does that look like in the context of our relationships? So I'll tell you how I like to translate it in my private practice and really with all the parents that I work with. One of the first questions that I ask parents when they come into my office is, if you had to categorize, it's a little different than we've heard in the past about compliments versus criticisms, but if we had to categorize every statement that we make to our children, every one, what would the positive versus negative ratio be? Let me explain in more detail. If I ask my child, please do your homework, that's a demand. That's quote-unquote, I'm not criticizing, but that's a negative comment. I'm making a withdrawal. I'm making a request from my child. So in my emotional bank account, in the relationship with my child, I've made a withdrawal. If I say to the child, please put your shoes away, that's a withdrawal. If I say you did a bad job, that's obviously a withdrawal. That's a negative comment. But it's more broad than just criticisms versus praise. But then there are other comments. You did a great job. That's obviously a positive comment. I'm so proud of you. Positive. You did your homework so nicely. You cleaned up your plate after dinner so nicely. Those are positive comments. And then what happens is we create a ratio. What is the percentage of all the comments that I make to my child? Positive versus negative. I'll tell you, in all of my years in practice, when I've asked this question, I think only once, maybe twice, has a parent ever told me that the positive exceeded the negative. Very often I'll ask spouses to rate each other, shalom bias permitting, how they perceive the other's ratios of positive to negative. And it's amazing that what happens is, when we shift the percentages from 60 to 40 to 40 to 60, a lot of times the behaviors that we struggle with go away. Even in the Bronx, in the inner city of the Bronx, when I would give, let's say, single moms this instruction, very often the behavioral issues would fall away. Now think about why that is the case. Because imagine you're at work and you have a boss who's always critical of you or always making demands of you, but doesn't compliment you for the things you did right, even though they're expected. And then suddenly you make a real mistake. And that mistake you shouldn't have made. But if that boss is always critical and already your bank account is on zero, so that you feel horrible. But if you have a boss who's always complimenting you for the things you do, even if they're the right things you're supposed to be doing anyhow, which is something that we fall into as parents. We have a lot of expectations. We get very aroused when a child doesn't do what's expected, but we don't compliment them when they do what's expected. And then suddenly they do something really wrong, and you make a withdrawal, and you say you shouldn't have done that. You want to correct them. But suddenly, you can't make that correction, or you can, because it all depends on the relationship that already has existed in the context of all of these deposits and withdrawals that we've already made. And it's something to reflect upon. And there are two ways to change how we do those numbers. We can limit the things that we criticize, but we can also increase the things that we praise. We often take them for granted. Thank you for putting away your shoes. Of course you put away your shoes. Thank you for cleaning up the table. Thank you for taking care of your brother. Thank you for doing your homework every night, or some nights, or one night. And it changes the dynamic in the relationships. When we do have to make withdrawals, and sometimes we do, it allows that connected relationship to be in place and the bank account to be filled. A second intervention, which I'd like to share with you, is as follows. Very often in school, by show of hands, who here has school-aged children? Okay. Who's a school-aged child? Awesome. Okay. So on the back, I have what I call Mondro's algorithm. It's not because it's not arrogant, I want them to create an algorithm. It's just because if you don't like it, you can say it's just Mondro's and you can just throw it in the garbage and nobody will be insulted. But what I found, I found myself having many, 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 many conversations like this in the schools that I work in. A child will come to me after finals are done already and they'll say, you know, Dr. Mondro, if I don't get a 90 or above on every single one of my finals, that's a true story, my parents are not going to allow me to have any friends over for the next month, and I'm not allowed to go to camp. And I'm like, really? Like, can you believe it? And I'm like, so on so many levels, I'm like, okay, and this is not the first time. There's a reason why it escalated. First it was like, you have to get out of this, and this will be taken away. And then eventually, they came to a point where, like, if I don't get a 90, everything's taken away. That's high stakes. So I start to think, like, this is not going to work. And more important than that, in every context of our lives with our children, more important than anything that we do is going to be our relationship with them. And it really came to the fore with me. We have, you know, as more technology is advanced nowadays, one of my colleagues calls it the technological arms race. It's us against our children. And they're always going to win. They're always going to be ahead of us. They're always going to know a little bit more of what app is available, what technology is available. It's almost impossible to win. Or there are going to be scenarios that come up where you always want your child to come and talk to you. So you have to be connected. So I came up with the following algorithm that, based on who we are and who they are and our relationship with them, the importance of having a positive relationship, realizing that they're not just buildings, but they're also plants, what we can put into place to affect change. And it goes like this. I'll walk you through it. And I think one of my colleagues, Rabbi Avi Wasser, helped me just give a little bit, my artistic sense is not so great, so he helped me organize it in a little bit of a more artistic, aesthetic way. So you have a scenario that comes up. Whatever the scenario may be, it could be in school, it could be at home. And the first thing you say to yourself is, well, this comment, this intervention, this approach will bring me closer to my child. He did a great job. I'm taking him to a baseball game. Johnny, wonderful. Is that going to bring you closer to your child? Hopefully. So, okay, check. You follow it down, no problem. That's easy. But here's when it gets tricky. Sometimes you say, okay, it's not going to bring me closer to my child. It's going to create distance. The child runs into a street, and I'm going to scream at that child because he ran into a street and almost got hit by a car, God forbid. So you say, the next question you say, is it worth it? Do we have to intervene, even though the child's going to be embarrassed and upset? Of course the answer is yes. If the answer is no, then we say, okay, we have to just leave the situation. I had a parent that came to me when I was working in the Bronx, an Italian family. And for whatever reason, the mother was fixated on the fact that the boy had to have cereal for breakfast. And all the four-year-old boy with tremendous developmental disabilities, all he wanted for breakfast was pretzels. And the mother was adamant, we're not having pretzels for breakfast, we're only having cereal for breakfast. So I brought her in and I said, look, why don't we look at the ingredients on the cereal compared to the ingredients on the pretzels? And they're almost identical, flour, water, salt, whatever, whatever. And she realized, okay, you know, maybe it's not worth taking the pretzels away. Maybe it's not worth fighting. So once the answer became no, so you said, just leave it. Let it go. So first we say, okay, is this going to bring me closer to my child? Then we say, okay, is it worth it? Is what I'm about to do, the comment I'm about to make, the intervention, is it worth it? Then the answer is yes. But then we ask one more question. Is it effective? It's worth it. I got it. When I yell at my child in the street and I scare that child so much that he'll never step foot on the block, is it effective? It should be. So then, yeah, yes, you go ahead. But now you say, okay, listen, the child wants to do well in school. A parent wants a child to do well in school. Is it worth it, even though it's going to push me away from my child? You could say yes. Okay, you should do well in school. But it's not working. It's not working. So if it's not working, then no, don't do it. And then you have to start again. And so if our guiding principles are to come closer to our children, so we're investing in them, the positive to negative ratio, and then besides the positive negative ratio, then we create a hierarchy, an algorithm that allows us to, in a very structured way, approach almost every single interaction that we can with our children so that we know, should we do this, should we not do this? And even if we should do it, is it working? And if it's not working, we have to start again and we have to think it over. So let's just review quickly, 2 minutes. We discussed the importance today of being able to reflect and to look at ourselves as parents, educators, as Jews, the importance of modeling for our children, not just talking the talk, but also, more importantly, walking the walk, because with that sixth sense, children will pick up on any sense of hypocrisy or disconnect between what we say and what we do. And with that, we have to realize that we have to view our children not in the context just of building where we put these rigid parameters on, but also of planting, that we provide the nurturance and let them to grow organically on their own. And that tandem, that integration, that synergy is really what allows for healthy chinuch. And in that context, we create a relationship. And that relationship is driven in many ways by the emotional deposits that we put in our relationship bank account. And we have to always make sure that bank account stays in the black, because if it gets into the red, we have to take a step back and reassess. And then the same thing when we put interventions in place. One of the driving questions that we always have to have, in schools as well, is first of all, is this going to bring me closer? And even if it's not, which sometimes it's not going to bring us closer, we have to be able to pause and say, is it worth it? If it's not worth it, leave it. If it is worth it, is it effective? Is what we're doing working? And then if it's not, if the answer is no to any of those questions, we have to take a step back, reassess, and start again. So I wish you all a wonderful day. It's really special to be a part of it, and I hope you're able to grow a little bit together. I have about 2 minutes. If I have any questions, either on anything here, or I can take personal questions afterwards. My pleasure either way. Yeah, sure.
On your algorithm, can you just walk through when you get to, is it worth it? Mm-hmm. How is it possible that it's worth it if it's not effective?
So it's interesting. So is it worth it, meaning before we even begin to assess the intervention, so we want to ask qualitatively, is it something that I even want to pursue? Meaning that before we even take the step to put the intervention into place, we want to think, okay, well, I have three baskets. Basket number one is for sure it's worth it, a child's safety, let's say. Basket number three is the cereal and the pretzels. Basket number two are things that, you know, you're not so clear about. So before we even pursue the intervention to see if it's effective, you want to be able to say, well, is it worth it that I'm even going to sacrifice, before I put anything into place, before I sacrifice the closeness of my child, am I even going to, is it worth it to even begin the process of the intervention effective? Yeah.
The example that do the homework, is there, the only black or white can be a part, or like a part of it, that you're not going into black or red?
Explain to me a little more.
Before you give an example, so, you know, every time you actually do the homework, it would be a control state. Is there somewhere you can turn that into, if not a positive, at least a part statement? So you're asking them to do the homework, but you're not withdrawing.
It's a little bit hard because any time a child, let's say in homework, when we're asking them to do it, we're making a demand. We're making a request. Now, you could try to deflect it off of you and say, you know, the school made the request. You know, it's on the school. The school said the homework, so it's not a demand from you. But at the end of the day, very often, if it's at home and it's with a parent, the child will associate the completion of homework not with the school, more with the parent who's enforcing the rule that the school put in place. So it's a little bit more difficult. But it's very easy to offset because there's so many times you can praise all the homework that is done. And the number, the ratio can be padded, pad the positive. And the ratio changes dramatically. I find that the greatest way to change the ratio is by padding the positive, not taking away the negatives. And very often we're just not trained to do that. We're trained intuitively to find out what's missing and to call kids out on it, to call our spouses out on it, to call our employees out on it. That's how we think. Whereas if we change that mindset, it's amazing what it does. And people, I'll tell you, at first children are like, whoa, like, why did, is everything okay? Like, you never compliment me. But it becomes a culture in the house where everybody starts to praise everybody and it just changes the entire environment. Sincerely, it has to be sincere. It's not fake. It's got to be real. Yeah.
Like, are you saying that if you continue, like, thank you for watching your brother? What? Because I never watch my brother? What are you saying? Like, so are you saying that if you just keep pushing forward, they'll get used to it and stop pushing back? Or you have to find more subtle ways of sort of increasing the positive that aren't as, you know, cause and effect based so that they're kind of, like, seeing it as a way of you trying to butter them up?
That's an excellent question. I would answer at least on two levels. The first thing is it goes to yourself. You have to ask yourself the question, are you trying to butter them up? And if the answer, not you, I mean, the parent here, I'm saying the parents are struggling with that. But if that is the case, then you shouldn't be, because you're not buttering them up.
No.
Because the goal really is to give a genuine right. compliment.
Right.
And then if that's the case then, that you're genuine, then when the child cynically says, oh, you buttered me up, then it's just unemotionally, matter-of-factly, no, I'm really proud of you. It's really helpful that you're taking care of your sibling.
Keep it going.
And then, you know, I told you, at first, like I said, the kids are like, older kids or younger kids are like, really? What? Really? And then eventually it becomes, no, like, if you say it enough times, and you walk the walk, and you talk the talk together, it becomes real. And then they begin to see, okay, well, mom really values that this. And it's not always easy to be, because you have to be careful that you're really being sincere about it. But I think that it does catch up, but it takes time. So if you start it with younger children, they're already used to it, and it's sincere, and it becomes part of the culture in the home, then it's no longer out of the ordinary for them in that way. Yeah.
If you're really not sincere, but you keep on doing it, then you could also cause yourself to become sincere.
That's also true. I agree with that. But that's, you know, that we're hopefully already past that. We're at a point where we really are sincerely. But I think that becomes all part of the relationship, being aware of who we are as parents and how we relate to our children. And I think that these are things that we can reflect upon, we can think about, and also hopefully implement. I can tell you that it works. I can tell you that this way of thinking, can't tell you the success rate, I haven't studied it, but I try to ask for feedback from parents that I work with, and both in school and in my practice, and everything needs to be tweaked, and there's more nuance and so on, but I think there's a lot to say about this kind of approach, and hopefully it's successful, and we should have a lot of hatzlacha. Okay. Have a wonderful day, everybody.